We'd like to take a second to thank our sponsor, Mouser Electronics. Not only does Mouser stock the world's widest selection of semiconductors and electronic components, they also offer an original content series called Empowering Innovation Together. Each month, EIT takes a deep dive into the hottest tech trends, and this month the focus is on 5G. Check out podcasts, articles, infographics, videos, and more at mouser.com/empowering-innovation.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Devendra Hardwar, Senior Editor at Engadget.
I'm Reviews Editor Charlene Lowe.
This week, we are going to be chatting about Facebook's Oversight Board decision, kind of the main decision we've been waiting for from this group, which is essentially Facebook's Supreme Court, or they, as they like to tell us, when it comes to Donald Trump's ban on Facebook platforms. And we'll be chatting about that with Carissa Bell. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to the Engadget Podcast on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and shoot us an email at podcast@engadget.com with any notes. We'd love to hear from you guys. And before we get started on the show, I do want to mention, hey, this is a little awkward. We were in the news this week. Verizon announced that it's selling Verizon Media and all of its properties, which includes Engadget, TechCrunch, and Autoblog, to Apollo Global Management for $5 billion. We're all going to be under a company called Yahoo. It's all stuff happening in the future. So let me tell you guys up front, we don't really know much else about what's going on. We're hearing the deal may close in the second half of this year. There's really, I can't see any real regulatory reasons why the deal won't be approved by the government. So that's probably going to be our new home at the end of the year. And just from our chats with folks internally, it seems like jobs are safe. We'll be fine for at least the next year or at least a year following the acquisition. So that's pretty much all we can say because we are still waiting to hear more about this. But I've gotten some notes from people who were worried about, the state of affairs in Engadget. I just want to tell everybody we're okay. We're all good for now.
I will say that I actually don't know if jobs are supposedly safe for a year. I think until the deal closes, we won't really know.
We won't know fully.
So for now, until close is a bit of a buffer period where we're like, okay, things are going to chug along for now. And then after that, if there are any big changes before the so-called year, we'll see. And then, often I think also when companies do a big buy like this, they don't want to be too obvious, within the first year of like letting people go and whatever. So I think we'll still be like, we'll have a little bit of a cushion, I think.
Yeah, scary times as usual in the world of media.
Disclaimer that while we will have a new name, we'll no longer be Verizon Media, we'll be Yahoo, but Tech Engadget is still Engadget. And we will have a new big parent company. Verizon still would own 10% of the Yahoo, the new Yahoo.
That's a whole
group.
Thing. At least so, then Verizon will be a minority stakeholder rather than us being Verizon employees, which won't affect anything really.
Yeah, except, I'll say that our disclaimers will probably still continue. That's all.
So this week, Facebook's Oversight Board finally announced a decision we've been waiting for a while, what they're going to be doing about Donald Trump and Facebook's ban on Trump. And the big news is that they decided to uphold the ban that Facebook originally instituted after the Capitol riots on January 6th, based on Trump's behavior at the time. But it is all kind of confusing and, to me, kind of muddy in terms of like what this oversight board actually did. So to chat about this, we brought on Engadget senior editor Carissa Bell, who has been reporting on all this stuff. Carissa, can you explain, first of all, what is the oversight board? Why should we care about what they're deciding? And what is so unique about their decision here?
I think what is unique is that it was, in some ways, like a lack of a decision. So the oversight board is this group that Facebook put together to, people kind of compare it to like Facebook's Supreme Court. It's somewhat independent from Facebook. It's a group of academics and free speech activists and,
politicians I've seen.
There's a former prime minister in there, people who have expertise in human rights and, free speech issues. And they basically kind of act as, Facebook's court. When there's a content decision that's, kind of borderline or controversial, people can send it to them. They'll sort of look at all sides of it and come down with a decision, and then Facebook has to kind of do what they say. So with Trump, the interesting thing is that they're supposed to decide, you know, whether or not his suspension would be permanent, you know, if they would let him back on Facebook. But instead, they kicked it back to Facebook and they said, you know, we're not going to decide this for you. We think you were right to suspend him in the first place. But it's up to you guys if you want to, you know, let him back on the platform at some point or keep him banned forever.
That is kind of wild. And they basically gave Facebook a 6-month deadline to kind of figure this out. So what they did is they actually approved the ban, right? They approved of what Facebook did and why they did it. And if you go to oversightboard.com, you too can read their decision making and kind of everything that went into it. But they say, like, yes, certainly it made sense to ban him at the time. Specifically, what they seem to have a problem with is the indefinite ban. So, which is a sort of like loosey goosey way Facebook framed it at the time. It's like, Trump would be banned at least until after Biden, you know, is officially inaugurated. And there was always that language in there. So they kind of had a deadline to like keep him banned to a certain point. And then after that, like there was no real reason to ban him. Is the oversight board just asking for like specificity here? Like, hey, just make a clear decision for the love of God.
Yeah. I mean, I think what they're taking issue with is that they basically said Facebook kind of made up its own rules in this case. You know, if you look at Facebook's community standards, there is no scenario where they, you know, give you an indefinite ban. And so they said, you know, you're right to do this, but you can't just make up a rule when it suits you at any moment. And this is something that, you know, they say that Facebook, you know, does a lot. And so they said, you know, we want you to actually, you know, explain your rules for politicians, explain your rules for influential users, explain to us, you know, a lot of these kind of controversial policies, you know, that we've seen for the past several years when it comes to Trump. And they said, and then decide. But, you know, the interesting thing about that is that they also, by doing this, there's a very not insignificant chance that at some point, whatever they decide, that the Trump thing comes back to the oversight board again. So, you know, we are stuck on this loop.
But that, you know what? Hey, that reminds me of the actual Supreme Court, which can often shoot a case back to a lower court or like just to say like, we're not going to deal with this. You guys decide. Like that is not an unusual thing. So it almost seems like a really smart use of their power on their end for the oversight board, because a lot of the criticism for this thing, right, is like when Mark Zuckerberg announced the oversight board, was it last year or a couple of years ago? Everybody was saying like, Facebook, you got to do more about these major, you know, there's a lot of like major decisions in terms of banning people or blocking posts or things like that. And Facebook as a company just never was really set up to do that. Zuckerberg didn't believe he should be the lone person to do that, or Facebook should be the company to do that. So given that this company is so huge now, has over 2 billion users, right? It made sense to set up this external body made up of people. It's vaguely independent. It is funded by Facebook. So technically, these people are being paid by Facebook, but they're being paid through like this third party. It is a whole like group of confusing things all happening all at once. Is this like Sherlyn? What do you think about this in terms of like showing Facebook's effectiveness? Was it actually smart for the oversight board to be like, no, we're not going to like blanket make these hard rules for you. We're going to agree with this and say you got to actually think hard about your own platform for once. Is that a better thing or yeah?
I think what you're saying about the confusion is actually very true, because when Carissa said that, you know, what they came down on and what they're asking Facebook for, which is like a set of guidelines before the fact instead of after the fact and making up stuff as you go, I think that's good that they demand that Facebook do that. But my understanding of this oversight board was that it was, and this might be my own lack of like understanding on the matter, but I thought it was going to be more of an advisory council for things to like for them to be consulted on before Facebook went ahead and did anything.
Oh no, they have a lot more power than that. Yeah.
Which is good, which I like that they have more power. It sounds like a Supreme Court is a better like approach here, right? As opposed to just a toothless advisory council. But it does sound like it's more for after the fact stuff right now. And that feels like less effective. It's more like Facebook can go ahead and do whatever it wants and then it'll just deal with the punishment after, like, don't ask permission, instead say sorry. Why do I say sorry weird? Anyway.
You're not Canadian. You don't say sorry.
I know. I don't know why I keep saying it that way. but yeah, so I, Carissa, I don't know if that's like, you know, you agree with what I'm saying, because I think it would be more effective if this oversight board had more, you know, power before things happened rather than after.
Yeah, I mean, you're totally right. And a lot of people, you know, have a similar point of view on the oversight board, is that, you know, one of the main criticisms, you know, besides, you know, there's people who say, well, you know, they're just set up to kind of help Facebook kind of avoid the hard decisions, right? They can just pass it off to this other group and kind of blame them if people don't like it. You know, but the other thing is that, you know, there's people who are really critical of the board and Facebook. They say, you know, this group has no ability to actually influence, you know, kind of the most troubling aspects of Facebook. You know, when you think about its algorithms, whether or not it recommends extremism, how it handles political advertising, you know, these, you know, very important and, you know, significant issues that, you know, the board can like recommend policies and, you know, critique policies all at once. But at the end of the day, like, Facebook doesn't have to do what it says. So in that way, you know, its power is much more limited. You know,
is this sort of like the symbol of oversight rather than actual oversight? That almost seems like where it is. There's a good article that's worth reading. It's called "Inside the Making of Facebook Supreme Court" at the New Yorker by Kate Klonick, produced like this February. So this was one of the pieces where this is the only like in-depth thing. I believe she was one of the few reporters to follow them from the beginning, and just the initial like meetings for the people on these boards just sounds like the worst like seminar, like just trying to get a lot of difficult people all together. And a lot of people who didn't believe this board could work were invited and just kind of like weren't playing along with what Facebook wanted. And I'm not saying they should. I'm saying like there was a lot of pushback internally too. So I'm really interested in like how the final board kind of shaped up, because there are people all over the world. It's not just like a Western world focused thing. There are people from India and Africa and all over the place. So on a like symbolic level, I kind of wish a group like this could survive or actually be useful. But Carissa, like, do you think this whole thing, is it just a way to like avoid true government oversight, which I think is the real thing Facebook and other companies are worried about?
Yeah, I mean, well, if you listen to Facebook, what they'll say is, you know, we welcome government oversight, and we would love, you know, new regulations that can kind of spell these things out for us, but that doesn't exist right now. You know, that there is no, the government is not doing that. So in the meantime, you know, the oversight board is the best thing that we have. Obviously there's a lot of people who disagree with many aspects of that. You know, but I think you're right. It's very, you know, I think it's going to be a while before we really kind of know whether or not this process is working, because it's going to come down to not just these specific content decisions. It's not going to come down just to Trump. It's going to be these kind of like bigger policy recommendations, you know, the things that Facebook doesn't have to do, you know, how seriously it takes that, you know, that advice, and how, you know, whether or not it actually makes substantial changes, whether it actually does kind of increase the transparency that the board is, you know, has been calling for. But I think it's going to be a while still before we actually kind of gauge whether or not that it's being effective on that front.
Yeah, and the board has made other decisions so far, right? Like, you could see all of this on oversightboard.com. There were decisions around posts. I believe like there was in Brazil, there was at least one post where somebody had their post taken down because it showed the picture of a breast, right? And the board decided like, hey, no, actually the context of this is, this was supposed to be an announcement about breastfeeding, or was it breast cancer?
Breast cancer.
It was something like breast cancer.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be like, yeah, informative. So therefore this band is not worthy. You know, this shouldn't have been blocked. So those sorts of things like seems like it makes sense. But yeah.
The breast example is actually a really good example where Facebook did make a concrete policy change in response to the board. Was, you know, they came back and they said, actually it was on Instagram. They said Instagram's, you know, policies around nudity and stuff like just aren't very clear. We obviously know that like people have been fighting about whether or not, you know, you can show nipples on Instagram for years. Facebook came back and said, you know, actually we're going to make an allowance for health related nudity. So if you're doing something that's raising awareness about a health condition or something educational, Then we will create, you know, this kind of carve out in our rules for that instance. So that was one example where they actually did make a concrete policy change, and, you know, probably something that, you know, people were, a lot of people were kind of happy with, at least.
I think, I mean, we mentioned Facebook, again, has over 2 billion users. It is more powerful than any single country, right? It has more influence in the world than any single country. So it does seem like, yeah, I suppose they kind of do need a Supreme Court in this way. They're acting like a nation state. I don't, like, based on your covering, yeah, what you've covered so far, Carissa, do you think this proves, like, was Zuckerberg right to create this thing in the first place? Is this a step towards making safer a better environment because even he realized his own limits here? Or is he just kind of, like, really working hard to avoid actual government regulation?
Well, I think it's a few of those things. You know, I think as much as Facebook says that they want new regulations, you know, I think they want very specific types of regulation. So I think in that sense that anything that kind of helps them avoid the kinds of laws that they don't like or that wouldn't be beneficial to them, I think that's something that's helpful for them. I think the board definitely helps let them show, you know, helps gives them a way to show that, like, you know, we are being responsible. We're trying to regulate ourselves. You know, but at the same time, I think that a lot of these content moderation issues that have come up, like, are extremely important to Facebook and are very significant. And, you know, we know that there's just not that many, like you said, Facebook is more than 2 billion people. It kind of acts like a government. You know, there's very few entities that kind of can actually, like, exert any kind of influence or push Facebook. So even though it might not be to the extent that a lot of people want, I think it's probably better than nothing at this point. You know, even for people sure, who don't sure. like the board or don't like Facebook have a lot of respect for the people on it. You know, these are very, like, serious, prestigious people. So I think for now it's kind of the best thing that we have in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and this whole discussion, by the way, is about, like, getting, can Donald Trump get back to Facebook and get back to Instagram, right? Because, those last few messages directly supported the Capitol rioters. Donald Trump launched his own platform this week. So maybe he doesn't need Facebook or social media at all. It's a website called From the Desk of Donald J. Trump. It is a GeoCities site. It's a Tumblr, you know, it's like a place for him to just, like, post his little thoughts and videos and photos and things like that. But it's a bad website. That's what it comes down to. So, yeah, maybe he doesn't need Facebook. This is all he needs.
I do have a question. And maybe it's, again, my lack of knowledge on this, but what was Twitter's take on Trump? I know that it felt more permanent, right? That was like a permanent ban and they had no issues.
It's a forever ban.
Yeah, an actual ban and not an indefinite ban, which was Facebook's thing. Yeah,
the wording is clearer on Twitter's end, and their decision, they're sticking to it. They don't need to second guess themselves. It seems like they had a clear set of policy or guidelines in place, and there was a clear violation, and therefore the decision was easier to make. So it seems like it's more worthwhile for Facebook to have clearer things, clearer guidelines in place. But I think you had a funny take, by the way, Devendra, when we were talking about Donald Trump's Tumblr. You said it was the Trumpler.
Trumbler. Just Trumbler.
Trumbler.
It's cleaner that way. Oh, R.I.P. man. Tumblr. R.I.P. Tumblr. So what we do know right now is that Nick Clegg at Facebook will be leading the final decision on Trump. He's a former policy guy, and he's, like, led a lot of major decisions there. So, yeah, it's back to Facebook eventually. We're just kind of waiting again, right? Right, Carissa?
Yeah.
And who is Nick Clegg, if you've done any reporting on him?
So Nick Clegg, he was the he's former deputy prime minister in the UK. And now he's basically Facebook's top policy official. He was brought on to kind of lead their, you know, communications policy, you know, these kinds of things that have really been troubling for Facebook in the Trump era. And, you know, it's that article that you have up right now. You know, there's a lot of good reporting in that about, you know, kind of his background. He's apparently very close to Mark Zuckerberg.
This is the New York Times article, British political veteran steers Facebook's Trump decision. So go check that out, folks.
So he's kind of, he's also the one who he steered a lot of, you know, the creation of this oversight board. He was very involved in like it's set up. You know, one of the also in that story, it points out that one of the co-chairs of the board, the former Danish prime minister, that they were actually like longtime friends. He was the one who kind of got her on board to be part of this. So he's, and it's not surprising, right? Like he was the one who's kind of been steering the responses to the oversight board. He was the one who, his name was on the blog post, that when Facebook first responded to this recommendation. And so he is going to be the one that is kind of leading Facebook's, thinking on this and the response to the board's recommendations. I think that's something that, you know, a lot of people who are critical of Facebook, who don't like the oversight board, are definitely not going to be happy about that. You know, Nick Clegg doesn't have a lot of fans outside of Facebook necessarily. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, kind of how that plays out.
Is there anything based on either his history or how he's been, you know, talking about things in the past? Do you have a sense of like where he could ultimately lie on this? Is he more towards keeping Facebook open, or is he more towards like, yeah, we got to make some actual final decisions here, ban him permanently?
I mean, I hate to make predictions, but, you know, if you think about it, like he's a former very high profile politician. I think that if I had to guess, I think he would be more inclined to, you know, not have a permanent ban on Facebook. You know, I mean, we know already that Facebook didn't want to make a permanent ban. If they did, like, they would have done it in the first place if they were like inclined to do that. So I don't think that they have more reason to do that now than they did on January 6th necessarily. So, you know, if I had to make a guess, I think that they would find a way to, you know, justify bringing him back at some point, maybe with some caveats, maybe with some, you know, we're really serious this time. If you break our rules, then, you know, maybe.
Oh, yeah. You naughty, naughty guy. Yeah. Don't incite another riot. Yeah. Otherwise.
You'll strongly have to worded.
What do we think will happen if that happens? Like, what is Trump, like, is Trump going to do some kind of triumphant return? Is he going to start inciting people again? Like, what do you feel is going to happen?
Well, I mean, with Trump, you never know. There's a lot of talk right now, speculation that he wants to run for president again. Obviously, we know that, like, Facebook was, you know, very instrumental in his previous campaigns. A lot of his success was because his campaign was very good at using Facebook's platform. So we know that Facebook will, you know, would be, again, like, hugely important to whatever he decides to do. In terms of, like, how he actually behaves, like, I don't think there would be any change. I think
look at that site now, right now, by the way, like, it is just like him yelling at people. The top post right now, the first sentence is Liz Cheney is a warmongering fool who has no business in the Republican Party leadership, which is the whole thing, because she has been somebody who hasn't fully supported him, and now the Republicans are kind of teaming up against her. Clearly he hasn't calmed down, right?
No
it's funny, that site looks a lot like Twitter too.
Yeah, it's like a really janky Twitter,
yeah. Bad Tumblr is why. It reminds me of, like, we all had GeoCities sites in the 90s. If you were around during the 90s, you young kids. But yeah, if you had a GeoCities site, I had a, you know, anime fan site in the 90s. This looks a lot like that, okay? And if you can find it, extra credit to you, audience.
Needs more glitter, though.
Needs more glitter, needs
and
more
marquee,
like
marquee
construction signs under construction, needs more blinking text, needs more flashing banners. Chris Abell, thank you so much for joining us. Where can we find you on the internet?
I mean, find me on Engadget, obviously, and on Twitter at Carissa BE.
Let's move on to some other news. Not a really great week for Peloton. Unfortunately, they had both a major recall of their, it's a voluntary recall of their fancy new treadmill after over 70 people have been injured by it, by getting pulled under, which includes pets and kids. There are 29 injuries to kids and at least one death that we know of so far tied to this thing. Seems bad. Seems pretty bad for Peloton, a company that's been known for the past few years for making, you know, pricey, high quality, premium, smart fitness gadgets. This is probably the worst thing we've seen from them when it comes to overall reliability and safety, which is important if you're an exercise company, right?
I was talking about this with Valentina Paladino, our commerce editor, who is very, you know, familiar with the fitness, mm-hmm. home fitness tech space. And she was explaining to me kind of what was happening. This is really, Peloton at first was like in the early days where like some of these reports were coming out, Peloton was still resisting, mm-hmm. you know, the mm-hmm. recall and saying that, and I don't know that this explicitly said this, but the idea was that you should keep the treadmill away from pets and kids and leave your safety key in the treadmill so that it doesn't just turn right. on without warning or, you know, when a kid nudges it or something. And what was happening for those, you know, little animals / little human beings can get in that little space between the base of the treadmill and the floor. There's a little bit of clearance Ooh. There. And yeah. they can get dragged in if they're playing around that area and the machine turns on. Yeah. So that's what has happened in a few cases. So Peloton's idea seemed to be that you should not be... Apparently some people were putting these in the playrooms where yeah. kids would
don't
be...
Don't you have a dedicated room
don't you have
for
a separate
Peloton?
Room? Exactly. If you have a Peloton, don't you have a separate room for it? It's kind of the question, but that's obviously not the right answer. Mm-hmm. So it's good to see the company finally recalling the Tread and Tread Plus, and also it's saying that it won't be selling these in the US anymore. No idea, honestly, though, with a global... what is happening elsewhere in the world, whether it's going to recall these or not. We shall see. Mm-hmm.
It's a voluntary recall. It's not like saying, yeah. hey, get all these things off the streets or anything. So they're still leaving it up to consumers. You right. could either get a full refund or they're saying you could hang on to it and Peloton will help you move it because they're really known for being very customer oriented, right?
Hands-on,
like they
right.
they have a lot of, yeah, they have set up, like they can give you set up when you're buying machine and stuff too. So they will help people move it to a different room if they can. But I think this is just really coming down to the fact that a lot of people don't have a lot of space. Yeah, sometimes you get to share a playroom with your exercise machines. That's the reality that we're living in, especially if you live in a city. This thing is also giant. You know, treadmills are big, but this thing is huge and much bigger than even the Peloton bike. So I could see a lot of awkwardness here in terms of how people are placing it and where they're putting it. Yeah, do you have any thoughts? Like, were you tempted to get the Peloton treadmill versus the bike?
Y'all, listen. The box that I live in is my bedroom, my living room, my playroom, my fitness room. The Peloton, if I got it, it would turn my space into like an unlivable dedication.
It would take up like at least half of your apartment.
Yeah, I would just have dinner on the treadmill. That's all I'd be like. I just put food, like a pretend like conveyor belt. Like a, you know, like how in Asia
that's
we
healthy.
Have like sushi restaurants that have like little dishes of sushi come out on conveyor belts. So I could turn the Peloton into that. Fun ways to repurpose your Peloton tread. If
fun
you
ways.
Want to
also,
back.
In other Peloton news, there was a security flaw that allowed attackers to grab sensitive user data, which is also a problem because Peloton has so much of your data. That is the whole point of Peloton. It is a smart fitness device company. So they have a lot of your health history. They have also probably payment information and other things too, because it's all kind of tied into your Peloton account. So not great. Not great. And it also took them a while to acknowledge the fact that there was a security hole too, right?
Yeah, I don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I feel like I understand the reason companies are a little afraid to be upfront and transparent when stuff like that happens. But, you know, we've talked about on the show before why it's important when there's been some kind of hack, right, that mm-hmm. you should let users know as soon as possible so they can go ahead and protect their information while there's still time.
For sure. It was Jan Masters at Pentest Partners said he discovered the Peloton security flaw and told the company on January 20th, but they didn't talk to him. Like they didn't respond to him until 90 days later when he started talking to media sites. So, you know, not great. I feel like a lot of this happens to a lot of companies too. Like if somebody's telling you, hey, your stuff is screwed up, here's something you should probably fix. You should probably acknowledge that and get ahead of it. And yeah, Peloton seems to be riding high on its reputation as sort of like the premier fancy smart fitness gadget, and I'm kind of glad I didn't buy into that myself. Like I just recently bought an exercise machine, but it was a one of the walker thingies.
Elliptical.
It's an elliptical, yeah. But it's a a nicer elliptical than the cheap one I used to have in my apartment, because I also got a cheap one when I was in New York. But it's not super smart, and it doesn't require a permanent subscription like Peloton products. So there are a lot of options out there. There are a lot of other like bikes, like spin bikes that you can buy now too, and other ways to put screens in front of it. So look at your options, because there's more out there in the world than Peloton.
And stay tuned to Engadget for more coverage on all of that, just as coming.
Yeah. What is going on with Android tablets? Because I saw you put some news down here, and I found it hilarious.
So this week, as is the case with every week, there has been a bunch of news from Google land. And let's talk about the one that I covered and was briefed on directly. This is Google launched a feature called Entertainment Space for Android tablets. And if you're wondering, what is an Android tablet? It's like an iPad that runs Google software. Anyway, Android tablets, right? We've made fun of them a little bit over the years because they have been in decline. But apparently, according to data that Google cited and found, apparently there's been a 30% uptick in people using their Android tablets in the pandemic. So, hey, if you're still stuck at home and bored to pieces, mm-hmm. and you're like, I wonder what I can do with this Android tablet. Or, you know, you have an Android tablet and you like it. There are people out there that like their Android tablets. So I'm not going to keep hating on you. There's a new feature called Entertainment Space. It's basically this portal for all of the entertainment-related content on your tablet. So we're not just talking movies, right? We're talking about there's three tabs in Entertainment Space. Watch, games, and read. So gaming and, you know, books are the other two. So in addition to, like, the watch panel is very similar to the Google TV interface. It basically features a spotlight carousel at the top where Google will recommend mm-hmm. you things that it thinks are timely. And then it'll pull in suggestions from the apps that you have installed on your Android tablet. So Hulu, Showtime, whatever you might have on there. As well as things that you won't traditionally find on, say, a TV platform, something that doesn't have a TV app but has an Android app,
sure,
and that
sure.
Google classifies it as a watchable app, so something like Twitch could also be.
I just have to ask you, though, Sherlyn, what year is it?
2021.
And when was the first Android tablet?
Dude, don't even.
It was like 2012. 2011. This whole I was cackling when I saw this news, because it was like somebody at Google being like, oh crap, we have tablets too. We should do something about this. We should give people a way to consume all their content in one screen. This is basically the thing Amazon did with the Fire tablets, in a way. Like, they just slapped a better interface on Android, you know, basic Android hardware and Android tablet stuff, and made cheap tablets. I'm not surprised people are using these things more now, because you can get some of them really cheap. I am surprised that Google is fine. It took Google so long to do anything when it comes to, like, a combined entertainment place to find all your good stuff on Android. This is the thing we've been complaining about for so long. Yeah.
So here's where Entertainment Space, I mean, here's a few caveats too, right? But let me finish explaining where you can find. So Entertainment Space on supported tablets will be on the left of the home screen. So kind of where usually you would find a Discover feed or whatever else your, you know, tablet maker puts on there. So you swipe right on the home screen to see Entertainment Space, and then like I said before, you have games and read as well, so you can get book recommendations from Play Store or Kindle, etc. in there. Now, the caveat that I was referring to, mm-hmm. Entertainment Space is coming to new tablets from Walmart, Lenovo, and Sharp later this year. So just these three brands of Android tablets for now. And they will be, you know, if you already own an Android tablet from one of these three brands, you'll get an over-the-air update to get Entertainment Space later this year.
Sure,
Google also said that it still has, like, other brands of tablet makers in the works that it might be able to announce eventually. But for now, it's just these three. And so, like... Mm-hmm. It's if you think it's a useful feature, also make sure you have the right brand of tablets. I don't know.
This is the exact problem with Android tablets. This is it. This is everything. Because, like, when you buy an iPad, you know, at least, okay, it may not be the fastest iPad or something. You can still run most of the apps, right? You can still get the basic iPad experience. Android tablets have been so fragmented for so long, and Google has never pushed very hard to get good tablet apps made. And now finally, Google itself has decided to, you know, give people an all-in-one entertainment spot. It's just hilarious to me. The best ones are Samsung tablets, right? And Samsung has its own interface. Mm-hmm. And there's probably going to be a big fight before Samsung even adopts some of this. And I think they have already some sort of unified experience, right, to find media. So, yeah, just kind of a mess.
Yeah, the thing with Samsung is that like a lot of their so-called unified experiences often also get labeled as bloatware by people who hate it. So we don't know about this one yet. Speaking of bloat, the option whether or not you can disable entertainment space if you don't want it is going to vary depending on your brand of Android tablet. So don't blame Google for that one. I will say that what you're talking about as a fragmentation is very in line with Google's typical methods, right? Which is to build like a very open base software for everyone else to kind of customize. And like, yes, there's we have our problems with that, but that's also not surprising, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. It's like, this is kind of what they've been doing for a while now.
Why would you buy an Android tablet now when the base iPad is like $329 and often goes on sale for $250? I bought one for my baby. It was $230, which is cheaper than the vast majority of Android tablets I've seen so far. So yeah,
I mean, there's plenty of Android tablets that are cheaper
other than
that.
The Fire ones. Yeah.
There's the Fire ones, like Lenovo makes cheaper ones. TCL also makes cheaper ones. Like there's plenty of cheaper options. I think the people looking for an Android tablet are those who want a tablet, don't want Apple software, or don't want Apple. But anyway. I was surprised by some other Google news this week. The company hilariously tweeted out its own announcement for the Pixel Buds A, the highly rumored, hotly rumored Pixel Buds A series.
Listen, they're Google. They don't know how Twitter works, right?
Right,
they don't know how to post.
And then they deleted the tweet like almost immediately after. But of course, this is the internet, and everybody screenshotted the shit out of that.
Do you think that was an accident, Sherlyn? Because if I were Google and I had these gadgets that aren't super like important, like not a huge deal, but if I could get a small portion of my audience hype for it and they think they found a secret, you know, and then they do most of the spreading and promotion of it.
Yeah.
Seems like that's a good plan too.
So I'll say I do think it's an accident because right after like our typical move is to like verify the facts and check with Google, hey, what's up, right? Before we just willy-nilly report on things as if they were fact. So it could have just been an accident, and that's why you kind of want to make sure you ask the source. And usually in this sort of situation, when someone has a major leak on something that Google's been keeping secret for a while, Google's recent tactics have been to fess up and be like, yeah, I hear you like leaks. Here is a picture of the Pixel 4's camera, for example, right? But then this time around, it did not. It kind of went, no comment. That's not the official word. They declined to comment on anything. And it seems, and the fact that they deleted the tweet so quickly after tells me that not only was this a definite accident, but they're also not fully ready to announce it. Like something in their marketing material is not ready yet or something like that. You know what I mean? So
what are these supposed to be? What is the point of the Pixel Bud A series?
Yeah, so these are highly rumored to be the... I don't want to like misreport here. My understanding is that these are like the affordable series of the Pixel Buds, but they also have new technology like fast pairing to make them just easier to set up overall with Google phones. So, I mean, I like the Pixel Buds. I use them. They sit in my ear really nicely when I am like being incredibly active. By that, I'm trying to say I'm a runner without saying I'm a runner. But yeah, the A designation, the A in the name, the way Google has used A in its product names in the past has been
for
more affordable.
Yeah.
Exactly. So we're kind of waiting to see what that means. But that's everyone's guess is that these are probably going to be cheaper than the Pixel Buds, which
that's
is
good.
Kinda cool.
You know what? We should do like a refresh chat about wireless earbuds soon because these things, man, are they cheap now? Like I'm seeing a whole bunch under $50. I'm seeing some like around $30 and they're not going to be the best sounding things. But it's just the fact that we're able to have this tech so cheaply and so disposably kind of worries me too, because we just lose these things and the minerals just leach back into the environment. But hey, things are getting cheaper and more accessible. That's good at least.
Yeah. Anyway, That wasn't the end of the Google news. There's one more, just a slightly interesting piece of Google-related information, which is Apple has hired a former Google AI ethicist. And I don't want to butcher their name, but it's not, the person who was fired for some of the whose tweets about how she they were being fired from Google. It's not that person, but it is someone else from Google's ethics or AI ethics team, and Apple has taken them in. So that's interesting.
Sammy Bengio, it looks like, or Bengio. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying not to butcher names. So, but yes, S A M Y B E N G I O. But here you go. We'll see if Apple has better. As a better approach towards AI ethics,
and we talked a bit about this when it happened. Like Google started leaking or started losing ethicists because it fired it fired her and a bunch of coworkers and things like that. And there was a lot of online consternation about how Google has been treating these ethicists because they dared to write a report that said, "Hey, maybe." Maybe the way we're doing these natural language models is wrong and potentially dangerous. Google does not want to hear that. So I am interested in seeing like where these people end up and if they will make AI. I don't know if they will actually influence ethical AI at other companies like Apple. I'm thinking Microsoft is a big one, too, in terms of what everyone's working on. So I guess we'll see. But man, the continuing saga of Google's AI ethics department or group is kind of just sad because they are screwing it up on every level, it seems. Let's move on to some news from Twitter. How about that? No longer will we have the click for a surprise meme on Twitter because they as of yesterday, the Android and iOS apps now have support for taller images. So your Twitter feed, at least mine last night, was taken over by much taller images of people testing like, hey, is this thing working? Kind of funny. Some of my favorite ones included one of like the actress Elizabeth Debicki, who is known for just being tall. She tall. So like people are like, can this fit Elizabeth Debicki? Yes, it can. Yes, it can. And other images like that. So it's weird to me a little because some images now take up a lot of the Twitter timeline. I'm not sure if you're liking the aesthetic, Sherlyn.
I still haven't seen this on mine, but I will say I tweeted a screenshot recently of my Google Discover feed making a terrible, terrible mistake. And it cropped half of the picture, so you only saw the very out of context screenshot. So I can't wait for the tall screenshots to come to my phone. I think I would be into the aesthetic.
Make them tall. I think for the longest time, Twitter was just trying to make every post like fit the same block, you know, fit the same size. And I'm fine with things being changed up, but man, certainly people were going a little crazy on this, and now I'm considering turning off loading images automatically just based on some of the things I've seen so far. So, you know, that's a thing. So big change aesthetically for Twitter, but what else is going on there, Sherlyn?
So we were talking just about AI and some of that stuff. Twitter, its other upcoming new feature it will start showing prompts when it detects that the tweet you've composed contains offensive language. So if you're saying, you know how like when you look at replies to your tweet, and maybe not everyone has had this experience, but when you look at replies to your tweet, it automatically hides the ones containing what it believes to be offensive language. And so I believe it's using the similar algorithm here to identify these. Anyway, when it can tell that you're being a little salty, but like crossing the line with your salt or their saltiness, Twitter will show a prompt that will ask you, hey, do you want to review this before tweeting? It will say, we're asking people to review replies with potentially harmful or offensive language. And then you can choose to send it anyway, edit it, or delete it. So one more step before angry people are able to send their angry tweets.
Do you think this would make a difference? Would this make a difference for you if you were angrily sending something to somebody?
I am already in my head. Have you looked at my drafts folder? Everybody needs to look at my drafts folder.
I can't look at your drafts folder.
Nobody should, is what I'm saying.
Seeing like what mess that is. Yeah.
It's a big hot mess of me being
Share your drafts folders challenge, everybody.
release the draft folder cut. But anyway, I am that sort of person that's already very like self-censoring. But do I think that this will be helpful for people who are not? I think it'll make them more angry. But it might give some people pause. It might give people like who are on the fence or like need a little bit of like reminder that, hey, be a human. I don't know. I feel like this prompt maybe should show a picture of cute kittens or like cute babies as well. Just to like calm people down.
Like a sad puppy, a sad kitten. Like you're making puppy sad. Don't make use the kitten cry.
Oh my gosh, use that prompt space for free SPCA ads. You know what I mean? Like, come on.
You bet there are going to be ads on these things soon. Oh, yeah. We started seeing prompts like this when it came to like retweets, right? Like Twitter started telling people, hey, you're retweeting this article. We didn't see you click through the link. Did you actually read it? Do you actually need to do this? Or are you just spreading misinformation? Which I don't think is generally a great thing, but maybe it stopped a little misinformation. So I'm fine with that. This just seems, I don't know. I guess on a certain level, it may help people to check themselves a little. I don't think this is like a fix-all to Twitter's problems when it comes to, you know, user abuse and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
And also, how about just disband the Nazis? Like, the thing people have been asking for is, like, get rid of the users who are actually actively making Twitter a toxic place. I think they've been really slow to do that. And certainly when it comes to, like, Nazis and white supremacists on the platform, it took forever before Twitter really started taking them seriously. I think those are the things Twitter users would actually like. But these changes always come down to like Twitter saying, hey, fam, we got this new thing for you. Please check it out. But it always seems like something from people who don't actually use Twitter, you know, like the people who don't actively see the problems on the platform. So this feels like another one of those out of touch things. So I guess we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I don't know if you have further thoughts, Rowan.
Yeah, two things real quick. One, the accuracy or the effectiveness of this feature, too, also depends on the accuracy of its algorithms, right? Like, sometimes I'm curious, so I click to see in, offensive replies to some of my tweets or to other people. Yeah. And just, like, not all of them are bad. Some of them, like, accidentally used, like, the word or, like, one of them had nothing to do with anything offensive whatsoever. Yeah. So sometimes it really is off. So Twitter also needs to work on its algorithms here. And B, the other thing is, where's my edit button, bruh? Come on.
This does seem like it could be something that could be part of an edit button eventually. Mm-hmm. But I do think the edit button would eventually work with something like the way Gmail's undo button works, send undo. Which essentially just doesn't send your email for 30 seconds while you think about it. I do think that sort of active delay and maybe sort of even like turn this into like an MMO or an RPG type thing where you have a cooldown, you know, like if you've tweeted too much or people are like, oh, no, nobody likes this tweet. It starts like actively working against your ability to tweet often.
What if I'm live tweeting a show?
Shouldn't, because they're all bad. They're always bad. Wow. Too many people live tweeting.
Excuse me, my live tweets are hot and popular and incredibly valuable. I don't know what you're talking about.
This is people the downside of it. As an aside, one thing that really annoys me too is I'm seeing more and more people live tweeting movies and TV shows that they're watching for the first time. And I'm like, it's like no wonder you're not really getting into this thing. It's no wonder you're not really getting into Citizen Kane because you're tweeting every 5 minutes. But let's talk about something a little more fun. How about that when it comes to pop culture? Are you excited for Disney's better new lightsaber? How about
that? What the hell? Well, tell me what it looks like. Does it look like the real thing is all I care about?
I mean, do you think it will it actually be able to hack off limbs and it's powered by plasma lasers?
I want to use one to carve a turkey.
No, Sherlyn, it's not so a real lightsaber.
That's
what are you talking about?
That's the only one I care about.
What are you talking about? But this is a semi-realistic looking, you know, toy lightsaber with a retractable blade.
Yes.
Which seems cool. And not like those like little kids' toys where it has like the segment things that, you know, kind of stick out.
Oh, I remember those. Yeah.
This looks like a self-rising, it looks like it rises like an actual lightsaber. Patent suggests it is using a motor with a blade made of LED illuminated plastic. So thank you again, LEDs. Disney put out a brief teaser. This thing we're going to learn more about this lightsaber when the Star Wars Galactic Star Cruiser Luxury Hotel opens at Walt Disney World in 2022. So it's all marketing.
So I had to go to a hotel to see this or buy this?
You got to go to a hotel. You got to like pay for the expensive hotel to pay a ton of money for this thing, most likely, because that is how the Disney scam works. But I have a lot of Star Wars nerd friends. I have a lot of Disney nerd friends, you know, the people who go to the parks, like when things were safe, like people were going to the parks like once a week. My friends around LA and California, they will get to Disneyland like as often as they can. They have those premium memberships, where you could just kind of run in. Right now, you could buy the really cool looking lightsabers at Disney's Galaxy's Edge. That's like the Star Wars, you know, part of the park. Those things cost $200 right now. I can only imagine what a retractable, semi-realistic lightsaber is going to cost. That thing's going to cost you a PS5. You know, that thing's going to cost you at least $500 or so for a toy, just for a toy. So, yep. That is where we're at.
You know,
Shulin, yeah.
Speaking of wild things that cost a lot of money, this week, something I didn't think would happen. Carol Baskin of Tiger King fame, the woman who we all believe killed her husband.
Allegedly.
We believe.
Potentially,
the way the Netflix docuseries presents it seems very strongly like she did.
We cannot say anybody killed anybody, Shulin. We just had our liability
training. No, I'm not saying. I'm just saying that I believe. I'm not saying that like I definitely know that she did it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is based on what Netflix's series put out there.
The
but
lawyers
anyway,
are coming right to you. Yeah.
If I state it as fact, then I had to say allegedly. But I'm stating my opinion. Anyway, Carol Baskin, the woman who allegedly is believed to have murdered her husband and fed him to cats. Anyway, this week launched a cat-themed crypto coin that her fans, aka all you cool cats and kittens, can use to buy her merch, from what I can tell.
This
is so strange.
Why this and not an NFT of just like the dumb stuff from her?
God,
you know?
I don't know. I hope.
Yeah.
Because with NFT, she can only sell one of each, I think. Who knows?
Okay.
She tweeted on May 4th about the new crypto coin called $CAT, which, you know, okay.
So is it cat coin? What is it called? Crypto cat?
I believe it's
Big
just
Cat Coin
called,
is the thing. Big Cat
I don't
Coin
know.
Is what's on the logo.
The sign looks like scat because it's a dollar sign.
It does look like scat. You gotta look at what your messaging looks like, people. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. But you'll have to listen to what she says. She said, I'm investigating crypto. In the statement, she said, I'm investigating cryptocurrencies because I am concerned about the volume of US dollars that are being printed and distributed with nothing to back them up. Our new dollar cat coin.
That's the concern.
Yeah. It's our new dollar cat coin is not a currency for investment, but rather is a currency of our fans to show their love for the cats. Oh, but Big Cat Rescue, which is the cat rescue that she runs, says it's also launching NFTs in 2 weeks, and the future plans include a big cat metaverse for virtual visits with the cats.
I don't know. Let's move on. How the Doge? How's Dogecoin doing? How about that?
On the other hand, Dogecoins, you know what? I don't even with Dogecoin. I try to stay out of cryptocurrency as much as possible.
Because it's infuriating.
It is infuriating, and you've mentioned this a few times, but the drain on our environment with the mining process is insane. But, you know, apparently Dogecoin hit like an all-time high in its price recently. I'm not super up to speed,
cents.
But Devendra, what do you know?
Yeah.
60
I mean,
cents!
Yeah. 60 cents, which is, I believe, what is it, a 10,000% return either from the beginning of the year or from last year?
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's a lot because when you were looking at Dogecoin like last year, early this year, it was in fractions of a percent, basically, like, or fractions of a cent, which is why people are like, oh, this is a fun, cheap thing. I'll put some money in here. And all of a sudden, your money is worth a lot more. I'm sure also we haven't really talked about this, but Elon Musk is going to be hosting Saturday
SNL.
Night Live.
Oh boy!
Soon, we everybody thinks like, and he has been a big Dogecoin like pusher for a while. So like, everyone's thinking like, oh man, he's just doing this to like push Doge more. Is Lorne Michaels a Dogecoin holder? Like, or is everybody gonna be rich because of this? I don't know. But it's kind of wild. It's wild.
Yeah, and to put it in context, the number of people that own Dogecoin is probably super high because why Dogecoin's market cap is now more than $70 billion. It is the fourth most valued coin according to Yahoo Finance's data partner, CoinMarketCap.
I hate this so much.
It's one of our family publications, I guess. Yes.
Sure.
To be clear.
I hate all the coins. I know. I've seen a couple of people. I don't know if you've like tried to experiment with this for Lynn, but I've seen a couple of people try to get a couple shares just to be like, hey, I wonder if I put $5 into this thing, what will happen? Yeah. To me, it still feels like, hey, you're putting money into a process that actively is destroying our planet for the dumbest reasons, right? For memes or to create a currency just for shits and giggles. It seems like that's what the big cat coin seems like it's about. So, yeah, not a fan. Let us know your thoughts about the rise of cryptocurrencies, people. Like, I'm interested in knowing what the normal person that's not surrounded by this stuff all the time thinks about this stuff. Can we move on to some quick celebrity goss news that we
celebrity
never really
in our world
celebrity
but
goss
also
news
in the real world.
It kind of hit me. So news broke this week that Bill and Melinda Gates are splitting up. And normally we don't talk about this kind of thing because it's private. You know, it's private lives, whatever. Do whatever you need to do. I will say I've always loved their partnership just because it seemed like, you know, Melinda Gates was kind of the driving force behind the Gates Foundation, which is one of the world's biggest donors. Like, it is a huge funder to a lot of different purposes and things. Like, they've been pushing vaccines and medical resources and things like that all over the world. There are certainly criticisms, and I think especially the criticisms around what Bill Gates thought about vaccine IP, which is the fact that he doesn't believe that basically the new COVID vaccines, that those patents or the you know, the recipes and the ways to make them, that he doesn't believe they should be shared around the world because they all cost billions of dollars from these companies, right? There was funding that went into them, so they shouldn't be free, which is a statement that that's a statement that the Biden administration directly opposed this week when they said they support it. Opening up all vaccine IPs because it turns out the world is still on fire. Things are horrific in India, which is the place where they're making a lot of the vaccines we're using around the world. Maybe we should let these things be open. So a lot is happening right now on the Bill Gates side of things. Sad news about his relationship, you know, like they've been doing a lot. I'm really wondering what this means for the nonprofit world and certainly for the foundation, because it's was it? It's like $5 billion in annual grants that thing has. Mm-hmm. Like, it is all over the world. It has 1,600 staff members. It puts money in 135 countries. I hope it doesn't mean, like, any of that stuff slows down just because of this relationship. And I hope, like, you know, Melinda Gates still gets to be in charge a lot of the stuff, too.
Same. I mean, I think this is sad news. The dissolution of any relationship is. Mm-hmm. And there were some good tweets that, you know, were entertaining.
There are some good tweets.
I'm not going to repeat them here because I think, to your point, I want to, you know, be respectful of what's happening to the two of them as individuals. But also, I think the more important thing here is the nonprofit work that they've been doing and that we hope they're able to continue that regardless of, you know, their relationship status.
Yeah, maybe we should just start a goss section because there was also the further reporting of what happened with the, the Jeff Bezos, the whole thing. Jeff and Mackenzie Bezos. Like, yeah, there was either it was Bloomberg or Business Week. There was a post about kind of what was going on in the background when Jeff Bezos basically announced to the world that he was actually having an affair and being, you know, being exploited by the gossip rag. So that's a whole thing. Go look for that. Because that's if you want to see the real gossip in the world, that reading that thing is wild.
If we have like a celebrity tech celebrity vertical whatsoever, we need a corner where I ask you, Devendra, how do you pronounce Elon Musk's kid's name?
Don't even know.
Because I don't know. I really don't know how to do it.
Doge baby. Okay, let's move on to what we've been working on. Did you know, Sherlyn, that Sony is 75 years old as of this week?
No, happy birthday, Sony.
Happy Hi. Birthday. Apparently, Sony doesn't want to celebrate because I've been trying to talk to Sony about this, and they're like, no, we're not going to have a birthday party.
They're afraid you'll ask them about the PS5.
or a lot of stuff. So we are going to be having some pieces at Engadget, I believe, this Friday, which is going to be Sony's, that's their 75th anniversary. So we're going to be looking back at this company that has dominated consumer electronics for so long. I'm working on a piece about like where Sony will go next. And since they're not talking, I'm going to have to like fish around and talk to analysts and things like that. But it is kind of wild. You know, Sony's a company that used to dominate everything. And then mm-hmm. Apple came around and basically like stole their lunch with the iPod and everything afterwards. Like yeah. It is now an Apple-led world and not a Sony-led world. But I think Sony still has a lot of cachet as a premium electronics maker. So we'll be diving into all that. Look out for our reporting over at Engadget. I'll also be testing some secret new hardware that I think you all will find really fun. How about that? That's all I can say.
Oh, okay. I think I know what you're talking about. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something I could bring to many rooms in my house. That's all I'm going to say so far. Sherlyn, what are you working on?
I have been testing Samsung's latest, which is the Galaxy Book Pro 360. And for those of you who are watching the YouTube live stream right now, I'm actually holding it up to the camera. This is the big boy. This is a 15-inch Galaxy Book Pro 360. Very, very thin and light. So far, pretty powerful. So, yeah, that review is going to come up soon. But in the meantime, I can already, I guess, answer a few questions about them. If you have them, you can send them our way via email or join us on the live stream Thursday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern thereabouts on the Engadget YouTube channel. But I'm mostly doing this, and then I'm finally, I'm taking some days off this week and next just to get a longish weekend in. But then I was going to take a full week, but I had to cut it short because of the review and because of like briefings for upcoming events that you all know about. So
May is going to be a very busy month, and we did not fully expect that. But hey, here we go. I will be taking like Fridays and one or two days like on and off when I can, because things be crazy. Things be crazy, sure y'all. Anything else you're working on, Sherlyn?
Trying to relax, y'all.
Let's move on to our pop culture pick, Sherlyn. What is helping you relax in pop culture?
First of all, I need to confess that I am in a love-hate/borderline-abusive relationship with Cooking Dash. This game, I play it so much. I love a lot of it, but I hate it so much because the glitches are annoying as hell, and like they'll deduct gold for no reason. Anyway.
And you're still playing.
Which one is Cooking Dash?
Is it a mobile game? Is it a Switch game? What's up?
Cooking Dash is this mobile game, and it's basically the part of the whole Dash series. So there's Diner Dash, Cooking Dash, Kitchen Dash. Kitchen Dash was Gordon Ramsay. Cooking Dash is the one where you run a bunch of restaurants or something. Anyway, it's just a simple time killer game. But that's not my recommendation. That's what I've been doing to relax, except I get so angry. Anyway, in an effort to get away from that, what I really do to relax / actually more like get inspired is I watch a lot of K-pop dance videos.
Okay.
On YouTube, I'm sure you can like find good videos just by searching for the words K-pop dance videos, but I'm specifically watching things like Blackpink's dance practice videos. Not the MTVs, because the MTVs often have like, you know, cut scenes to other things. I just want to watch the full dance. Because like, not that I try to learn them, but like I'm never going to be ever at that level. but the dances are just so incredible. It's like the dedication they have to their craft is really great. And, you know, every move is like clean and snatched. And like the moves themselves are not difficult. It's just the way it's choreographed, the way the band members move around makes it look really visually interesting. And you can veg out to good music and watch people be incredibly slender and lithe and agile in their 20s.
Which basically be pop stars. Do they, awesome. I mean, my only question for you, Sherlyn, is how do they match up to the guy on TikTok who just does the sick Michael Jackson dances in the middle of the street? Have you seen that
guy? I have not seen any of TikTok, no. So I will have to watch it.
Where,
you have to send me a link.
I know. What? Of all the things, Sherlyn is refusing the TikToks. Come on, it's where all the young people are. Come TikTok
with us. But I just want to be a K-pop star.
There's this guy, I'm sure they're also all over TikTok too, but there's this guy who just like, I think has perfected the moonwalk and pretty much every Michael Jackson movement. And he will pull up to red light and just get out and do a full dance for 30 seconds while the red light is going, then hop back in the car. It's pretty cool.
Sounds dangerous.
It looks like he is, it's kind of dangerous, but it's just also like, talk about confidence. Like, I don't know. This guy just out there doing Michael Jackson moves in 2021. I kind of respect that.
So for me, I mean, it's this attests to it, right? Like, it's very relaxing and calming actually somehow to watch people be baller ass dancers. But I also wanted to tie it in a little bit to AAPI month, where, you know, it's May. It's a month where we recognize Asian American and Pacific Islander heritage, and watching K-pop videos is part of that. Sure. But also I through the YouTube algorithms and the YouTube hole, I started watching this show called Youth With You. I'm not going to like dwell too long on it because there's some controversy going on right now with season 3. But basically, it's a reality TV competition series where about 109 girls and each or guys, depending on the season, compete to be one of 9 members in the new Asian pop band. And it stars like...
I like the slogan at the top of the image we're seeing here is, we'll get there no matter how far. Get where? What?
Yeah, I don't even... Yeah.
Huh?
But the mentors in this, the two women, there's two women and two men. The two women are people I know. So Blackpink's Lisa, an incredible dancer, like one of the world's best. If you look up her dance videos, they're amazing. She's the dance mentor on this. And then Ella... the other woman, she's the voice mentor, the singing mentor, and she's actually from a really famous girl band from my youth, SHE, which stood for Selena, Hebe, and Ella, the names of the three girls. This was great. They came up with names for themselves based on that, I think. Anyway, Ella is like
Yeah, I can't believe you're not watching Carolyn Tuesday on Netflix yet, because this is all the stuff you would kind of love too. Yeah.
But that was, I mean, it was fun to see people like try to be a star because I want to try to learn things. Anyway, last thing I will shout out for AAPI month, I started watching with my friends through a recommendation from our friend Alex Kranz, who has been on this show before, Warrior on HBO Max.
Warrior is very good. Yeah.
It is pretty freaking great. And usually Alex Kranz's recommendations are hot, wet trash.
Alex and I talk about action stuff all the time. So how dare
you? She talks to me about Asian shows all the time, and she's always picking the worst ones. But this one was good. it's on HBO Max. It's got some really good fight scenes, very interesting story. Now, don't, if you understand Cantonese like I do, just suspend your frustration because it's not all good. But everything else is pretty okay.
That's usually how it goes, all right? Yes. I remember like when Crouching Tiger came out, there was a lot of complaining about was it Chow Yun-fat's and Michelle Yeoh's accents? Because they didn't quite speak the dialect. So, hey, whatever. More representation is good. Warrior is a lot of fun. It's on HBO Max now, so everybody can check it out. It used to only be on Cinemax. Yeah. So it was one of those like shows of like I could only talk to certain people about because nobody had Cinemax back in the day. So
That's cool.
And you're enjoying it, Sherlyn?
I've only seen the first couple episodes so far. It's definitely like an HBO show, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Sherlyn's
winking at the camera. We're trying to wink.
Yeah, it's. I can't wink. This is an Engadget open secret. But it's that sort of show where you can't watch it with kids. But, you know, it's definitely enjoyable.
So I actually made it back to the theaters for the first time in over a year. And I've just been so happy about it. So last week marked my 2 weeks after my second COVID shot. So. Nice. Fully immune, but you know, nothing's perfect, so I'm still being really careful and safe. But I went to go see Scott Pilgrim versus the World in theaters in Dolby Atmos, and loved it. Love this movie. This is one of my favorite movies of the 2010s. The original time I saw this thing, like at Comic-Con, it was like whenever this movie came out, it was like 2012. But that was such a like great experience, and just such as like being surrounded by geeks. After the movie ended at Comic-Con, like the curtain came up and Metric played like a full set. Like it was such a great experience. So being able to like relive that as my return to cinema, and it's also a fantastic movie, was just such a joy. So if you are vaccinated and you feel safe and you can make it to like a fairly sparse screening. I went to a matinee and sat in the front row, far away from the handful of people that were there. I would say go check it out. This movie is perfect. I love this movie so much. And it reminds me why like Edgar Wright is also one of my favorite directors working today. It just has everything. So check it out. Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And if you've never seen it before and can't make it to theaters, stream it, rent it, whatever, buy it. It's fantastic. Also want to shout out The Mitchells versus The Machines, which is a new animated movie on Netflix this week, which is about a very weird and quirky family that has to survive the robot apocalypse together. And just have to say, I really love this movie. We also reviewed it like in depth over at the Slash Film Cast. So you can go check out my full thoughts there. But this is like a follow. This is Sony Animation's like big follow up to Into the Spider-Verse. So it has like similar animation and similar cell shading. I just really love the style of it. It is a movie that's bursting with personality. It's about a kid who just feels out of step with her family and the world and is weird and unique and likes to make movies. And she's excited to go to college where she can be around other, you know, weird creative people. But her family doesn't get her, and it turns out the robots are about to, you know, take over the world because a tech billionaire released this new product that made his old product sad, basically, and made all the robots and tech hardware like turn against them. I think for the Engadget audience, you'll probably get a lot of out of this movie. Certainly, there's a lot to suspend your disbelief here, because it's not like it's definitely not like tech accurate. And even when it comes to robot apocalypses, I do feel like Terminator did the idea of something that I've always been afraid of just like our connected AI becoming too smart and taking over everything. Whereas this one, it's not as smart. And I don't think like all the imagery kind of gels together, but so much fun. Love the characters, love the music. It is worth checking out. It's The Mitchells versus The Machines on Netflix.
And that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, and I podcast about movies and TV at the /filmcast@slashfilm.com.
If you want to send me videos of people being excellent at dancing, which is a skill I unfortunately don't have, you can send them to me on Twitter at Sherlyn Lowe. Email us your thoughts and feedback at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.
Once again, we'd like to take a second to thank our sponsor, Mouser Electronics. Not only does Mouser stock the world's widest selection of semiconductors and electronic components, they also offer an original content series called Empowering Innovation Together. Each month, EIT takes a deep dive into the hottest tech trends, and this month the focus is on 5G. Check out podcasts, articles, infographics, videos, and more at mouser.com/empoweringinnovation.